On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Pope Benedict XVI just got a big public lesson in the volatile global politics of religion these days, especially when the subject is Islam. From Rome to Iraq to the outback of China, angry Muslims have been up in arms over the Pope's citation of a 14th century Byzantine emperor asking what other than things evil and inhuman had come from the Prophet Muhammad. Now Benedict's been burned in effigy in Basra, a nun's been shot in Somalia, the Pope has apologized, the Vatican says he was misunderstood. But the questions raised by his provocative reference and the violent Muslim response have not gone away. Up next on Point, what everyone means to say in the meeting of two great faiths. We go first today to Rome and Tracy Wilkinson, Rome Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. Tracy, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, how are you?
Well, great. As you report, apologies are not exactly new from the papacy. John Paul II apologized 10 times during his papacy for slavery, for the conquest of populations in Latin America, for the Holocaust. What's different about this apology?
Well, John Paul's apologies were in reference to historical errors by the Church. Benedict has apologized for remarks that he made, although we must be clear, he's not saying that he did anything wrong. He's saying that what he said was misunderstood, and so he is sorry, deeply regretful for the reaction to what he said.
This is a kind of apology we've become familiar with in many settings around the world. Take us back to last week. What was the setting, and what was the focus of the Pope's address?
Well, remember, he was on a trip to Bavaria, his homeland. It was sort of he had visited the house he was born in and the church he was baptized in. So it was sort of a very low key visit home, essentially. But he's not one to miss a chance to deliver a message, and his theme of the importance of faith and reason in faith was something he was developing all along. On Tuesday, he was at the University of Regensburg, where he had taught theology in the 70s. And before a large group of fellow academics, he delivered this speech, a very complicated, complex, long treatise, really, over faith and reason that contained the remarks that have now become so objectionable in parts of the world.
Most of the speech was aimed at the West, the Christian West, if you will, saying it's been too focused on reason, too unreceptive to faith. What was the reason for bringing in this quotation from the 14th century emperor?
Well, that's actually a good question, because one might argue that if he wanted to make a point, the other point he was making was about violence and religion, and that religion should never be used to justify violence or vice versa. And he brought up the quote from the Byzantine emperor. One might argue it would have made more sense to use an example from past Christianity, the Crusaders, or some period like that where there was violence in the name of Christianity, and that might have avoided this problem. You're right, the speech was not really about Islam at all, but that's how he started it. That was the example he used, and he mentioned the word jihad and said that violence is never part of God's will.
Now, in his apology on Sunday, he said, "I'm deeply sorry for the reactions in some countries to a few passages of my address which were considered offensive." The Pope went on to say, "The true meaning of my address in its totality was and is an invitation to frank and sincere dialogue with great mutual respect." What has this Pope's position been on interfaith dialogue between Christianity and Islam?
He wants an interfaith dialogue that is much more frank, candid, that sort of puts all the cards on the table, so to speak. It's a very different kind of interfaith dialogue that his predecessor, John Paul II, promoted. It's much tougher, much more to the point, and very sort of hard-edged, I guess. And so that is what he was saying. This was an invitation to dialogue, and some people suggests that he used the examples from Islam to, in fact, provoke a dialogue with Muslims as well.
It may not be the dialogue he expected. How does the Vatican look at what at the situation as it stands today, Tracy? Is this thing calming down, or is it still roaring on?
Well, clearly they're nervous at the Vatican. They have tried to do what they can to extinguish this. They have sent their diplomats, the papal nuncios, to world leaders in some in different countries to try to explain what the Pope meant. They are doing what they can to sort of pat it down. It's hard to say where it's going to go. It still hasn't reached the most intense violent levels, for example, that we saw during the controversy over the cartoons. But it's hard to say. I mean, we've seen some leaders in the Muslim world coming out with more conciliatory statements, but others not. Others insisting they still want not only a fuller apology, but an explanation of what the Pope really does believe about Islam. Mm.
Quite a week around the Pope's remarks and an eyeful and an earful for the Vatican. Tracy Wilkinson in Rome, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tracy Wilkinson, Rome Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. I want to go now to the University of Notre Dame and Scott Appleby, professor of history at the university, director of the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies. He's author of The Ambivalence of the Sacred, Religion, Violence, and Reconciliation, and Strong Religion, The Rise of Fundamentalisms Around the World. Scott Appleby, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
What did the Pope mean to say here?
The Pope has been trying to sketch and develop an interpretation and approach to Islam. And I'd have to say this was a clumsy way of doing it. He's made remarks before, even in this pontificate, that outlines a position that is roughly as follows. Islam is a religion of goodness, of holiness, but it's being hijacked by extremists. On the other hand, the Pope has a deep background in the Second Vatican Council, which teaches that Roman Catholicism, Christianity in general, possesses the full and final revelation of God. And other faiths are not as complete as Christianity, but they do have elements of goodness and truth. So there's a line he's trying to march. He doesn't equate Catholicism and Islam, and he clearly sees deficiencies in Islam he sees, which he thinks leads to violence. What he doesn't do as good a job of is looking at the violence in Christian history.
When a pope talks about or quotes an emperor, Palaiologus, long ago, 14th century, talking about evil and inhuman teachings of the prophet Muhammad, what does he expect to happen in response to that? How do you explain the fact that a pope sets this out in the middle of the very kind of already volatile table we've got globally?
As an academic, I explain it in part in the fact that he's an academic, and sometimes academics can be a bit too subtle. There's no question that he wanted to make a point, and it was a point about the importance of reason in spreading the faith and avoiding compulsion. And he did refer both to Christianity and Islam, but he took this dialogue as a way of putting forth, clumsily, I must say, an earlier statement about the relationship between compulsion and reason in religion, and he pits Islam against Christianity. It was clumsy, if that's the word we can use, and ill-conceived in that, first of all, he puts it in the context of a period of time, the 14th century, mm-hmm. after these terrible bloody crusades. He has the Christian emperor invoking a slander against Islam. The Pope also, as John Esposito will explain more fully for you, he misquotes the Quran and dates the passages inaccurately. So this all too subtle academic intent to invoke a dialogue through citing a 14th century passage was both naive and ill-conceived. Naive in that he'll learn now, if he didn't know before, that whenever he says the word Islam, the world is listening, and they're not going to parse things in the way an academic does and expect you can have an academic conversation without riling feelings. So, and he'll also be much more direct and precise, as he normally is when he wants to say something about Christian-Muslim relations.
But let me ask you this. So this phrasing, this quotation, perhaps clumsy in your word, but what about the more fundamental critique? Is it equally offensive to Muslims? Is he saying there's a criticism for the West here? He says it's too much stuck on reason, but is he calling Islam unreasonable?
He has raised a doubt in many minds about whether or not the position I ascribed to him a moment ago is really his position. That is, does he think that Islam itself is a religion from God and of God, and that it's being hijacked by extremists. It was clear before this speech last week that that was his position. Now he's raised the possibility that he believes that Islam itself as a religion is defective and leads to murder. I don't believe that's what the Pope thinks. I hope it's not what the Pope thinks, and he has to do more to clarify that. But clearly by this ill-conceived quotation and a failure to develop his thought in that text or subsequently, he's raised that possibility, and that's a real problem if he doesn't clarify it.
We've been joined from Notre Dame, University of Notre Dame, by Scott Appleby, professor of history there. Right now from Washington by John Esposito, professor of religion and international affairs and professor of Islamic studies at Georgetown University, founding director of Georgetown's Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding. John Esposito, thank you for joining us.
Delighted to be here.
What do you make of this events of the last week? What's going on here?
Well, I think that your previous speakers, in particular Scott, were right on the mark. I just underscore things in the following way. I think, first of all, the Pope's speech was not about Islam. References to Islam were a very small part of that speech. He did not intend to offend Muslims, but in fact he did. And there's good reason for Muslims to be offended. His statement was not only clumsy, but regrettably inaccurate at critical points. But again, we've got a human issue here. The Pope is very, very bright, but he's an expert on Roman Catholicism, not on Islam. And one has to wonder about the people who are, as it were, advising the Pope or giving him his materials to read from which his positions come.
John, take us back, if you would, to this quotation itself from a 14th century Byzantine Empire, Palaiologos, if I've got that correct, to a Persian scholar. Here they're exchanging letters a long time ago. What was the intent back then? Was this emperor putting this in the face of the Persian scholar? Was he insulting Islam in the original letter?
Well, clearly it reflects the time in which it occurred, or the times in which it occurred, as Scott said. These were times when, in fact, you had the Crusades, when Muslims and Christians, as a result, had been in conflict. This is the Eastern Byzantine Empire before Constantinople was actually then taken by the Muslims. And so the emperor is, A, not a scholar of Islam, and clearly he's a partisan. You would almost expect him to say the kinds of things that he said, but these statements are totally inaccurate, and the fact that they are made about the Prophet Muhammad makes them, if you will, exponentially offensive to Muslims.
What are the inaccuracies that you see in the Pope's statement?
Well, the inaccuracies are to talk about Muhammad as evil and inhuman, and to say that he...
Well, it was his teachings.
His teachings.
And in fairness, the Pope said, as he introduced this in his speech, that these are comments from the emperor which have a startling brusqueness, a brusqueness which leaves us astounded today. So he did sort of set the stage. He said, brace yourself. This is going to sound rough.
But he didn't say that they were inaccurate or false. And the fact is, in his statement, he's quoting somebody who's saying that that Muhammad commanded the spreading of the faith by the sword. Mm. And that simply is not accurate. It is true that later rulers used military means, as was common in those days, or if you will, the sword, to spread Muslim rule. That's true. And indeed developed a rationale of jihad. But that is not in the Quran. It is not in the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad. And even when Islam was spread by the sword, one often has to distinguish between spreading Muslim rule and actually using, as it were, military means to force conversions.
No. What about, I want to stay with this sword business for a minute because I think a lot of people really wonder. There's some reference to force and violence. Was it number 9? I'm looking for this reference, and I don't see it in front of me right now. Help me out here, John Esposito.
There are clear references in the Quran. For example, slay the unbelievers wherever you find them.
Yes, that's it.
Okay, but that reference has to do with telling the Muslims of the time that they have a right to fight against the Meccans, who were, in fact, persecuting Muslims. It's not a generic statement about unbelievers. And indeed, when you look at the Quran, when it talks about jihad or the struggle for Islam, it talks about it as a, as it were, a spiritual struggle, as well as defending oneself or the community against those who attack oneself. It's later in history that you have Muslim rulers and religious, some religious leaders legitimating it, interpreting jihad to legitimate, if you will, their offensive wars of expansion. But this is not in the Quran, and it is not what Muhammad advocated.
Scott Appleby, John Esposito, please stand by. I want to bring another voice into this conversation, and I'm glad to have him with us. With me in the studio today is Imam Salih Yücel. He's second imam at the Revere Mosque in Revere, Massachusetts, Muslim chaplain at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Children's Hospital in Boston, founder of the Boston Dialogue Foundation, fostering interfaith dialogue in the Boston area. Imam Yücel, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
What do you think of the Pope's remarks as a Muslim?
When I heard the news about the Pope's speech and reaction from Muslims, the first thing that came to my mind was how Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessing be upon him, would respond to this speech. I took an imaginary trip to Mecca, the Holy Land, and walked the path of the Prophet himself and had walked. He and other Muslims were persecuted, tortured, and forced to immigrate from their own city. But when he conquered Mecca without bloodshed, what he did, he forgave all of those who disapproved his message and who killed his uncle, who killed many Muslims. So I thought that the Prophet would say about the speech, we'll forgive and ignore the popes too.
Forgive and ignore, but clearly that's not been the sentiment in many of the streets in the Islamic world. How do you explain the Muslim reaction that we've seen, so volatile?
Well, there are some reasons, I think. First of all, there are educational reasons, economical reasons, political reasons, and plus, of course, to say anything about the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessing be upon him, especially about his message that it is inhuman, it really hurt the Muslims, and including myself. And by the way, I would like also to mention that those who reacted violently, it is un-Islamic, and it is not the idea of mainstream Islam and Muslims throughout the world. And also, it really hurt me to and none to be killed in Somalia by, we don't know who, but by some
just
people.
Just in the last day or so.
Yeah.
We've got a lot on the table here. We want to let our listeners in on this conversation as well. Imam John Esposito, Scott Appleby, please stand by. Salim is calling from Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Salim. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I thought that this unfortunate incident would at least lead to some introspection on both sides. As a Pakistani Muslim, I certainly feel there is a culture of disrespect in Muslim communities as well. And I'm very glad that the Imam has addressed this, that within Islam, certainly, there's a verse in the Quran which says that don't defame the gods of other faiths, lest they defame your God. Mm. So clearly the reaction is un-Islamic. But I think there's a bigger problem, and that's that even some of the educated Muslims, they have not been introspective in this. And in this way, I feel it's not just a simple issue of education or economic hardship. There is something much more systemic which has to be addressed. And we need more imams, certainly, such as your guest, to address that. But I feel that he's in a minority, unfortunately. So as a Muslim, I think we are really trying to grapple with some of this kind of bigotry within our faith, which is alien to the theology, but it's become very much part of the popular culture.
Bigotry potentially on both sides here. Salim, thanks for your call. Imam Yücel, what about it? Let's go straight at this. There's a sense in the West that there's too much infatuation with violence in the Muslim world. Is this just extremists? Is this something that's deep in Islam? Are we misinterpreting?
Well, I think there is a misinterpretation of Islam, and the voice of mainstream Muslims are not being heard properly in the Western world. This is the first. The second, usually media is focused on the sensitive issues. Instead of listening or hearing the well-known scholars throughout the world, their voices, they are looking for Bin Laden voices.
But this is the Pope. This is the Pope speaking.
Yes, but on the other hand, the concept of respect to the religion, to the faith, is different in Islam from the Western culture. For example, we do not joke with any biblical prophets, including Jesus or Moses or Muhammad or God.
No cartoons.
No cartoons. Mm-hmm. And if that happened to Jesus or any other biblical prophets, peace and blessing be upon all of them, I think the Muslim also would be hurt. So that's why I'm not the minority. The majority of the Muslims, I think, will agree with me, and I disagree with the last caller, Salim, who said that the imams is minority. I think we are not minority. We are the majority, but we are not being heard properly.
Scott, yes, please.
I just like to set the context. Also, the imam referred to a context. A new Gallup World Poll of Muslims from Morocco to Indonesia, some 800 million Muslims, when asked in an open-ended question, you know, what do you resent most about the West? One of the widespread responses is the denigration of Islam, the denigration of Arabs and Muslims, and the tendency to equate Islam with terrorism. So, you know, that's a context in which we're talking about mainstream Muslims, not extremists. We're also, for many Muslims, there's a sense of a growing Islamophobia. You see the reactions to, for example, the European cartoons. And I think that what the imam said is very important here. You know, what we need to look at, yes, there are extremists out there that are exploiting it, but we need to be asking ourselves, why is it that a majority of Muslims around the world find it offensive? You know, heads of state, other rulers who've been close to us, religious leaders, even though they say we need to also continue the dialogue, why do they find it so offensive? And I think that that's something the Pope will have to, you know, struggle with. I think Scott's right in saying the Pope is a strict constructionist. But I think that when it comes to issues of, for example, reason and faith, you know, historically, Christianity had problems with Galileo, the Inquisition, the Index of Forbidden Books. So, you know, the Pope ought to be able to appreciate the fact that the issue of faith and reason is an issue that all of the monotheistic traditions have had to struggle with and move beyond.
Yeah, let us look at that. Scott Appleby, let me ask you this. I mean, here we are. There's a billion plus Christians, a billion plus Muslims. Clearly, there's no alternative here but getting along. But the Pope is saying he wants a frank conversation, which means let's point at differences. So are there fundamental conflicts here that can't be kind of put into, you know, some realm of harmony? Is there a conflict here that has to, because of the sort of internal logic of each religion, that has to come even to open conflict? Or can we, you know, get along?
Brief answer, no, there's nothing inherent in these two religions that dictates there will be conflict between them. But there's an awful lot of work to be done. Let me give you 2 points and piggyback on what John and the Imam were saying about America's ignorance of Islam. That's the larger context. When you get your notions from Islam from the headlines, you're going to get a distorted notion of Islam. We have been an insular nation before 9/11, and even after 9/11, suddenly books on Islam hit the bestseller list, but it hasn't made a big enough dent in the general ignorance of Islam, which requires study. First of all, it requires language study, Arabic and other languages. It requires the State Department and our government to employ a Muslim or two in the inner circles, which they have not, stunningly, and so on. So the point of the fact is, America has been insulated and doesn't understand Islam, and the Pope really, as John pointed out, is no expert in Islam.
But when the headlines say 9/11 terrorist attacks, whether you're educated in Arabic or not, that's an act that people look at and make judgments on.
Sure, and if they make the judgment that this represents Islam, it's a false judgment that's ahistorical and inaccurate. There is an explanation, several explanations, for why extremists in Islam have come to the fore, one of which has to do with failures on our part in terms of our policy reactions. We spent months asking, why do they hate us? Well, anyone who was paying attention would know why some people in the Islamic world hate us and others are suspicious. It's to summarize briefly, it's a set of policies that privilege our wealth over against the poverty of many other nations. The question is not, do we need oil to heat our homes, but do we need it for the extra house and the boat? In parts of the world where American military adventurism and corporate adventurism keeps people or is perceived to keep people in poverty, there are not enough boats being lifted there, there is real distrust. And then there are deeper insults and offenses that go along. So your original question to me, is there something built into these religions that cause conflict? The answer is no. If you look at their teachings, there's disagreement. There's a different notion of God. Christians will argue that Jesus never even counseled self-defense. Now, that can be debated, and that Muhammad was born into a context where he had to defend himself and his community. So there's a dialogue right there that some Muslim scholars, Aziz Sachedina, Professor An Naim at Emory, John Esposito himself, have tried to begin a discussion about nonviolence in Islam and whether or not Christians have lived up to their own nonviolent ideals. So there's a lot of common ground to talk about, and a general 99% of the teachings of these faiths complement one another.
Imam Yücel, are you worried that we're on a path to the clash of civilizations here that people talk about, in spite of that?
Partially, yes, because what we know about, let's say, definition of jihad by the Pope.
Holy war, he called it. Mm-hmm.
Actually, the holy war, when we translate it in Arabic, it will be al-harb al-muqaddasa, which there is no such expression in the Quran or in the Hadith, the saying of the Prophet. Mm. And the war is not holy. And also, the word of jihad and word of the qital or harb are mixed or confused sometimes by the translators of the Quran or by some, maybe some Muslims too. Jihad is to struggle, to strive, but harb or qital means war. When I did research in the Quran and also in the Bible, what I have found, there are 39 verses related to the war in the Quran. Mm. And there are over 1,100 verses related to war in the Bible.
Mm. I've been joined in this hour by Imam Salih Yücel. He's with me in the studio today, and we're very glad to have him. From Notre Dame, by Scott Appleby, professor of history at the University of Notre Dame, and from Georgetown, John Esposito's with us right now. Dan is calling from Kent, Connecticut. Hi, Dan, you're on the air.
Hi. It strikes me that the reaction on the part of Muslim extremists to the Pope's words, chanting death to the Pope, burning him in effigy, burning churches, and tragically murdering a nun in Africa, indisputably prove that the Pope was right. And I'm very glad to hear the imam actually denouncing the violence of these Muslim extremists. And I would like to ask him, what is the responsibility of more mainstream leaders within the Muslim community in the wake of this, to use the word that was used before, hijacking of Islam by these extremists?
Imam Yücel.
They have a great responsibility, of course, to show the right way to the people, and I think they are doing that, and they are trying their best to do that. However, as a Westerners, I think we should focus on why that's happening. You know, why? What's the reasons? If you look at the Islam since 1400 years, nothing happened like that. Why that's happening? Last 10-15 years. The second is it is not just a matter of the extremists. I think we should look openly and also understand, just put ourselves in the shoes of the Muslims throughout the world. You know, last 10-15 years, what happened, and almost 95% of those who were killed by the terrorists, they are Muslims. And still, those terrorists claim that they are Muslims, that they are killing innocent Muslims. So they are asking why they are killing Muslims if they are Muslims or run by the Muslims. The second is, as a Muslim, we respect the other faith. And one of the previous caller, he mentioned about the verse that even we cannot abuse their whatever they worship. So we are expecting that the other faith and traditions to respect our faith and traditions too. You know, to believe or not, that's belong to each individual. However, to respect, I think it is part of our culture, I mean in the Western value too, to respect other faith. Unfortunately, that's not happening. And when I say not happening, not in everywhere, but even the comment of the Pope recently did not help that. What we know that these mistakes, whether it is done intentionally or unintentionally, I cannot make any comment, but it is very simple basics, and how the verse of the Quran can be misquoted from the Quran, how the jihad can be translated in that way, and how Islam, how he said that Islam does not appeal to human reasoning. If you look at the Quran, there are hundreds of the verses clearly explain, don't you think, don't you contemplate, don't you this and this. So even the first command of God for the Muslims is to read. Read what? So when we compare that, you know, what's happening today in the both worlds, I think we have to focus on dialogue, to know about each other. But unfortunately, from the Western point of view, this is the view of one of the professor at Catholic University in Washington, D.C., Professor Sidney Griffith. He indicates that usually the Westerns, they focus on the political Islam, which is just less than 5% of the Quran. And they ignore 95% of other side of Islam.
Tom? I want to turn to John Esposito, if I may, for a moment. And John, you hear what the imam has to say. You hear Dan's question. And let me ask you here. Do you see this as really just an issue of great mutual ignorance? Because, I mean, I think people are listening closely here, and they really want to figure this out. But when the Pope steps up and says, you know what, we may have some structural problems between these two faiths. You've got reason and you've got absolutism on the other side. He quotes this emperor. You know, is I think people say, well, is it enough to just say Islam doesn't have a problem with violence? Does it somehow?
I think that it's a very good question. And, you know, I've been in the field for more than 30 years, and what I tend to say to people now when I speak publicly is that I'm in a terrific field. I have a better job than anybody else because for 30 years I'm asked the same questions, but in different contexts.
I'm sorry for that, but here we are.
And it's one of the reasons that I wrote a Q&A book called What Everyone Needs to Know About Islam after 9/11, because whether it's the Pope or the President of the United States, whether it's government or military leaders or others, while some have some good knowledge, it is astonishing how we're still functioning in a kind of world of ignorance and of stereotypes.
But there are facts on the ground. There are acts of violence. I think people don't want to hear anything that sounds like a soft sell. So be as hard-edged as you can about it.
Well, I mean, here's the hard-headed part. You have widespread, we've just had a problem with widespread pedophilia in Roman Catholicism. Do we judge Roman Catholicism, the faith, by what a minority of whatever we want to call them extremists do? Do we expect the Sheikh of Al-Azhar, rather than, let's say, if he believes there's a problem in Roman Catholicism in terms of celibacy or whatever, we might think that, okay, he can raise that with the Pope privately, but would there be a great tolerance for the Sheikh of Al-Azhar making public speeches, kind of, as it were, trying to correct his brother, the Pope, on these issues? The fact is, extremists do exist, and they commit violence in the name of Islam. They commit violence in the name of Christianity, blowing up abortion clinics, killing people, etc. But what we do when we deal with extremism in Judaism and Christianity is we very quickly and almost intuitively distinguish between what a minority of extremists do and what the faith and the mainstream believers believe and do. We don't do that with regard to Islam. And so we're always asking mainstream Muslims to somehow step up to the plate and explain why they and their faith, you know, are not violent. Dan raised a very good question about the media. And the answer is, if you look at the internet, you will see both on this issue and since 9/11, comments from Muslim leaders all over the world, mainstream Muslim leaders, denouncing violence and terrorism. Yes,
but you can also find on the internet the extremists in huge abundance.
That's what I just said. You will find the extremists too. But one of the questions it raised, Tom, is why is it that most Americans and most people in the world are not aware of what mainstream Muslims have said and always say, how come after 9/11 they did not step up to the plate? It's because the media prefers to privilege, which is understandable. The media is concerned about competition.
Well,
in the
maybe it's
line.
The media, but we're talking here about the Pope, in Turkey, Ali Bartakoglu, head of the Turkish government-run Religious Affairs Directorate. Here's what he has to say about the Pope. He says Pope Benedict should, quote, replace the grudge in his heart with moral values and respect for the other. This isn't just some, you know, popping off journalist. This is the Pope who's raising this issue.
Oh, precisely. And I think that part of the problem you have is that this Pope is early on in his papacy, so we shouldn't judge him for everything. He also has shuffled a good deal of his councils and experts, including some of his top experts, that is, some of the top experts that John Paul II had on Islam. And it's not very clear who his experts on Islam are now. That's why I said earlier, I think the Pope got bad advice. I don't think the Pope should be, in a sense, held responsible. I think the Pope, people will be looking to the Pope and saying, look, you don't just send envoys around the world. Mm. It would be very appropriate for the Pope to call in Muslim religious leaders and intellectuals and have a discussion on what he said and why, but also for him to be able to hear what Muslims have to say about their positions on faith and reason, on violence, yep. on terrorism, mm. etc.
We've got fear on both sides here, the sort of fear. I mean, I think people wonder, Muslims the same, I guess, if we open up and reach out all the way to the other side, can we count on the other, or do we get whacked in the end? Fort Washington, Maryland, John is on the air. Hi, John.
Hi, yeah. I wanted to make a comment and get a response from, particularly from John Esposito.
Yes.
And it had to do with whether these religious traditions, Christianity, Islam, whether there's something intrinsically or inherently violent about them. And my comment is, it seems that, in fact, there is. When in Christianity, when Christ says that, I don't come to bring peace, but I come with a sword. When Muhammad says that it's okay to kill non-believers, even in self-defense, both traditions condone some form of violence, as opposed to, say, the Buddha or Gandhi, who say that it's not violence is not okay no matter what.
But both also speak about peace and harmony. So what do we take from that, John?
I think what I'm wondering is that, I mean, if you have Buddha or Gandhi who say that violence no matter what, it seems that the fact that you can justify violence in Christianity and in Islam shows that there's something in them that may be different from other religions.
Let us take the thought. John Esposito, the caller, says, you know, have we got problems with both of these? Do we need to look elsewhere entirely?
I think that the question is an excellent one. I think that there is a problem within monotheistic traditions. I think it runs deeper than the way John sees it, and that is the question of if I'm right, if God has sent special revelation, and I have a covenant, and particularly in Christianity and Islam, I have a universal mission to spread that faith. Then what does that mean in terms of the propagation of the faith, in terms of the work of missionaries, in terms of, quote, getting people to convert, and is compulsion part of that? And indeed, Christianity and Islam have struggled with that and are increasingly coming to grips. Roman Catholicism, Vatican II, for the first time accepted what we would consider to be a notion of modern religious pluralism. But I think with regard to John's specific take on it, I think, John, the way I would say is there's a difference between the legitimate use of violence and the illegitimate use of violence. And I think we have to recognize that. And indeed, if you look deeper within Buddhism and within the Hindu tradition, you'll see that plays out there.
Let's go to Mount Airy, Maryland, and Cornelius. Cornelius, you're on the air.
Thank you. This is sort of a takeoff on Mr. Esposito's remarks, in that I think that perhaps the Pope, in his remarks, was subtly trying to establish his primacy as a mediator between God and man. We know that Islam regards Muhammad as exclusively filling that role,
yes.
And we know that Christianity, it's the Pope. And I think perhaps there was, with the rise in Islam, the Pope may have felt it necessary to subtly reestablish his primacy in that role.
So pushback from the very top of the Catholic Church, Scott Appleby, do you hear it that way?
There is extraordinary competition, especially in sub-Saharan Africa and parts of Asia, between Catholicism and Islam on this very question of conversion, proselytism, and so on. The Catholic Church is worried, desperately worried, that it's losing ground in some areas, and that has to be somewhere in the Pope's mind. Can I go back to the previous question,
yes,
though, to make this point about violence and religion? The John mentioned Buddhism. If you'd like to see some violence from Buddhists, you can go to the tiny island of Sri Lanka.
Mm-hmm.
The point is that in religions, there is a call for extremism or militance across the board. That is, religions ask people to sacrifice their lives, their fortunes, even the welfare of their families sometimes, not necessarily in a violent cause. And in all these religions, there are powerful prohibitions against violence of different types. But there is a dynamic in religion which is militant in the sense of giving yourself for a cause, and that can easily be channeled into violence, which is often prohibited. But it's a challenge for Catholicism as well as Islam and even for Buddhism.
Imam Yücel, let me ask you, one of the things that we know that is a conversation going on in the Vatican is about reciprocity. The Saudi government can build huge mosque in Rome. Rome cannot build a huge cathedral in Saudi Arabia. The Pope is this Pope is said to be concerned about that, saying he wants reciprocity. Is that possible?
Well, before answering your question, I would like to make a comment about the previous caller. He said that, you know, the killed non-believers are, when we take, you know, out of the context the verse, it will be misunderstood. In the Quranic science, what we know we call asbab al-nuzul, which means the reasons of revelation, because each verse or chapters were revealed for some certain reasons. That verse, which specifically indicate that kill unbelievers, it was released for a group of the people who came to the Prophet, and they said that they would like to become a Muslim. They became a Muslim, but they were sick, so the Prophet asked them to go and live in the mountain, and the shepherd will take care of them, which they went, and the shepherd took care of them. Finally, when they got well, they killed the shepherd, they killed all camels, animals, and they run away. And that verse killed these unbelievers. It is specific.
So you've got to know the details. I want to get one more call, and we'll go to the bigger issue. Sharif is calling from Hyattsville, Maryland. Hi, Sharif. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. How are we doing?
Well, what do you think? What do you see?
Well, to go to the first question, can Islam and Christianity get along? They can get along famously. Example, my name is Sharif. Obviously, I'm Muslim. My wife is not. She's Christian. But we've been married, and we get along wonderfully. We both took a look at what was said by the Pope, and before we could really go on a tangent of saying, oh, this is bad, this is the other, we had to get the full aspect of it. The problem was the media pumped it up with just, hey, this is what he said, and a week later, what he said was this, and it means this.
But you've got Islam and Christianity under one roof there, and you say it's working. You think it can happen globally as well?
It depends. Yes, it can easily happen. The only problem is Man is fallible, and that's the major problem within the world today. Regardless of what faith you practice, the faith, if it's run
from its best impulses. Sharif, our clock is winding down. Imam Yücel, the last word, it looks, goes to you here. Are you optimistic that we can turn the tension in this relationship around, and what's Islam's role in that?
Well, I think we have to promote dialogue between Muslim and non-Muslim community, especially Christians, Jews, and other denominations too. The second, the Westerners should focus on the roots of violence and why that's happening, the causes, and try to solve that. The third, especially those who are the prominent scholars or the Pope or religious leaders, they should avoid to make such comment which can create violence between the extremist groups from the both sides. And finally, I would like to say that we need some time to do that, and everyone, every individual should make effort to achieve this goal for the peaceful world.
There's a call to everyone on all sides as we walk through some eggshells here. Imam Saleh Yücel, second imam at the Revere Mosque in Revere, Massachusetts. Wonderful to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Scott Appleby at Notre Dame. Scott, always great to have you. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And John Esposito at Georgetown University in Washington. Professor Esposito, thank you so much for being here.
Delighted.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.